This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life. Welcome, everyone, to the Gravity Commons Podcast. My name is Ben. I'm here with Matt. Hey, Matt.
Hi, Ben. Good day.
Good day to you. Christy's not here with us. She was unable to join us, but she is normally our third co-host of this podcast. But occasionally, yeah. She's got stuff going on. She's got six kids. She's got a full-time job. You know, she's a busy woman.
She is busy.
How are you this day, Matt?
Yeah. Thanks for asking. I got two good nights of sleep, so I'm feeling pretty solid. Was up for like an hour and a half this morning and realized I hadn't yawned. And that was like, seriously, Ben, I was like, wow.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
I hadn't yawned.
Like that's unusual.
Yeah. It was out of the ordinary and it was striking. And I was like, I could get used to this, you know? But I'm, and we're recording this here at the end of April and I'm keenly aware that spring is in full swing, and there's a couple things coming up in spring that I need to get ready for. The first is I'm going to start. I usually do this after Mother's Day, but I'm getting ready to plant my plants, my garden.
Yeah, that's awesome, man. That made me think.
I expect
some
more fanfare.
Yeah. Apologies. It made me think of my garden, and that made me think like, oh wait. Am I going to do something this year? We just got into this new house. I don't know anything about what's in the backyard. Anyway, so I was just, sorry, I was making some calculations. I was like, wait, do I have time to think about this?
Okay. Yeah. I saw you kind of glitched out there for a second.
The process is running in the background. So you're excited about your garden, getting some seeds in the ground.
Yeah, excited about my garden. I've got a friend who's who's got a grant. He's an English professor at a school here in town, and he gets a grant every year to plant this garden on his college campus. So he runs this community garden on his college campus, and so he gets like hundreds and hundreds of different varieties of pepper and tomato plants. And then he's unable to use them all because they run out of room, and so I get sort of the scrap. Nice. I get the leftover scraps. He throws me about 30 plants every year that he's growing in his basement right now. Nice. Under grow lamps. And it's always like a great potpourri of amazing. I always discover new varieties of peppers and tomatoes getting these from him. So I just have to make room for them all.
That's awesome.
So I got to go buy some soil and condition the soil a bit. So I'm thinking about that. I'm also thinking about a golf. Ben, I used to play golf a lot, and I haven't played golf very much because it takes a lot of time and money, but also because I haven't had a golf buddy, but I'm going to play golf this week. And nice. I'm pretty excited about that.
With a new golf buddy?
Yes.
That's exciting. It's very good. You know, you're commenting about spring has me remembering something that I'm excited about.
Oh, yeah.
It was just last night, as we're recording this, last night, I feel like I went to like our first concert of the season, of the kind of the spring and summer and fall concert season. Live music is something that I really, really love to go and participate in. So we went to a show last night with a band called Always, spelled with two V's, not a W. So you know they're cool that way. So anyway, they're a fun band. I went with my wife and with my daughter, my 20-year-old daughter, who told me that this band, they're like, what's this band's genre? And then, you know, there were some suggestions that it was dream pop. And my daughter told me that she thinks of this band as shoegaze. Have you ever heard of shoegaze?
I feel like you're making words up, Ben, just to impress Gen Z. Right now, you're making things up to impress our 16 Gen Z listeners.
Right.
I'm gaslighting them into thinking, listeners.
I'm gaslighting them into thinking that this is a term that they... I invented it, but they don't know about it.
No, it does sound like made-up language, though, to this Gen Xer here. I just want to register that.
But that's what I told her. I said, what do you mean shoegaze? Like, why? Like, what is that all about? And she said, well, because it's like the music is so ethereal and they use so much like reverb and effects on their guitars, they have to look down at their pedal boards a lot. And so the effect is that they look like they're gazing at their shoes. And I was like, that is really funny and makes sense, even though this band did not spend a lot of time looking at their pedal boards. A lot of meaningful eye contact. It was nice.
Okay.
Anyway, so I'm really excited about live music. So.
Yeah, I know you are. That's good. Well, glad to hear it, Ben. I'm excited about this interview today.
Yeah, me too. Speaking of live music.
Yeah. No. We got with Rabbi Shai Held. He doesn't sing for us, but he does talk about his book, Judaism is About Love, Recovering the Heart of Jewish Life. I was super encouraged by this conversation, and I find as someone who, as a Christian, who's come into a faith, Christianity, that was that is Jewish in many ways, that I have a lot to learn about what it means to be Jewish, not so I can be Jewish, but so I can honor the tradition and heritage from which I come from. Yeah. And Shai does an incredible job in this interview and in this book of helping recover what is often seen as un-Jewish or anti-Jewish, which is love, right? Yeah. And so we talk about that in this interview and talk about how core and central love is and how Christianity has not cornered the market on love. Nay, it is also what it part of Judaism.
Yeah. 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 I find, you know, we interviewed Rabbi Danya Ruttenberg a few months ago. You can go back and listen to that one as well. And I found these kinds of conversations to be very interesting. And it's part of, I think, my growth in my faith, maybe part of my deconstruction and reconstruction of faith, is going from seeing Judaism as almost like a foil, you know, against which Christianity is the good news, right? You know, legalism and, you know, all the kind of tropes about kind of what, I don't know, at least what I grew up thinking Judaism was about, and kind of growing into, seeing Christianity more like, I guess what the Apostle Paul talks about it is like being grafted in. To something that, you know, that we didn't invent. And so anyway, it's been really enlightening interviews with folks like Shai Held and Danya Ruttenberg. So eager to share this with our listeners.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into it.
Here we go.
Rabbi Shai Held joins us today on the Gravity Podcast. He's the president and dean of the Haidar Institute. He's received the prestigious Covenant Award for Excellence in Jewish Education and has been named multiple times by Newsweek as one of the 50 most influential rabbis in America and by the Jewish Daily Forward as one of the 50 most prominent Jews in the world. Rabbi Held is the author of Abraham Joshua Heschel, The Call of Transcendence, and The Heart of Torah. And he is the host of Haidar's newest podcast, Answers with Held. Today, we're chatting with Shai about his latest book, Judaism is About Love, Recovering the Heart of the Jewish Life. Rabbi Held, welcome to the Gravity Podcast.
Thank you, Matt. Good to be here.
It's great to have you. I wonder if maybe by way of context about who you are and how you came to be doing the things you're doing, if you could tell us a little bit about your journey in Judaism. How did you become a rabbi, and did you grow up Jewish, or is that something you came to later in life?
Yeah, thanks. So, you know, what I would say is that I was raised in a kind of cognitive dissonance experiment. I was raised in a fairly unobservant Jewish home, very, very Jewishly knowledgeable. My father was a professor of Jewish studies at Columbia University. Wow. My mother was a teacher of Hebrew literature, but it was very, very cultural. We were not particularly observant, but because my parents wanted me to be knowledgeable and even learned, they sent me to Orthodox Jewish day schools. And, you know, I have an older brother and an older sister, and the gap between what we were learning in school and what we were learning at home mostly rolled off them. For me, somehow, from the time I was in third grade, I was coming home and asking my father about theology. I have a very vivid recollection of coming home one day. I really must have been 8 or 9 and saying, you know, my teachers tell us that God wrote the Torah and gave it to Moses out Mount Sinai. I know you don't think that's true. What am I supposed to think? And my father, who was very secular in many ways and did not have a philosophical bone in his body, he was a philologist, you know, a linguist. You know, he was just like, oh my God, like, I don't know what to do with you. And, you know, from a very young age, you know, I decided that my room in our house was going to be Shabbat observant. Like, it was going to be a different part of the house. So, you know, I was drawn to this from a very young age. And I think that what I would say is that I'm trying to think what the best way to put this is. I think that as I got older, I realized that I had been blessed with something I did nothing to earn, which is that when I talked about my religious questions and struggles, people seemed to want to listen, and people often found like the language I was using helpful, I guess. I don't mean that to sound grandiose. I just, yeah. I felt very lucky, and I found that there was nothing I enjoyed more than people sharing with me their own struggles around questions of meaning. What does it mean to be a Jew? What does it mean to be a human being? What does it mean to make our way in this world? And I just, I find it to be such an immense privilege to sort of accompany people in their journey to try to make meaningful lives and to live lives worthy of having been created by God.
Yes. What, that's beautiful. The phrase that comes to mind is like providentially and precociously religious.
You know, that is a little grandiose, but you know, I'll leave that for you to say. Yeah, I mean, I you know what I would say? Precociously theological. I wasn't sure that I was actually religious when I was young. I was sure that those questions mattered to me more than anything else. And I talk about that in the introduction to the book. This notion that part of what it means, maybe a central part of what it means to be a religious person, is to care deeply about the questions. For me, it's not about certainty. It's about passion.
Yes. Mm. Yes. Maybe by way of jumping in here, Shai, when I opened the book, I expected to read a book about Judaism, but we probably weren't 100 words into your book when the word Christianity occurs. Mm-hmm. And I want to read this little anecdote, and then I'd love to hear you unpack it a bit. You said that the book began decades ago in a classroom of senior students at one of America's major rabbinical seminaries, and you remarked in passing that Judaism is built on the idea that God loves us and beckons us to love God back. Seemingly bewildered by what I'd said, one of the students declared, "I'm sorry, but that sounds like Christianity to me." And you then unpack that anecdote in the book, and it seems like that was a liminal moment for you where you realized you had theological and even pastoral work to do to reclaim love as the bedrock of Judaism. Could you talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I would say that in retrospect, certainly not in that moment, but in retrospect, I came to understand that that was one of the moments of my life that really set the course of my personal and professional journey, if you will. I was really taken aback by that student's response. And what I said to him in the moment was, you know, it's so funny that you say that because I was alluding to the Jewish morning and evening liturgy in which we say to God, with great love have you loved us, and then recite Deuteronomy, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. In other words, God loves us and beckons us to love God back. The fact that that sounds like Christianity to you just suggests how deeply we've internalized a traditional Christian anti-Judaic trope, right? You know, the historian David Nierenberg makes, you know, the case that Christianity in many ways thrived on telling a story whereby Judaism was a loveless religion, and so Christianity had to come into the world to repair that. And one of the things that it took me a long time to understand is that that narrative had been internalized by Jews, and I find this is true across the denominational spectrum, the Jewish denominational spectrum. I mean, there's a kind of internalization of this idea, and it's a very hard sell to convince people that that's false. Now, I will say, I don't talk about this in the book, but perhaps in this context, it's worth mentioning. I had another experience a few months, I think it was a few months after that, but it was very close together in time. In any case, I was teaching at an interfaith conference for high school students. And this shows you how far back it goes. The students were divided into Protestants, Catholics, and Jews, right? It was something out of Will Herbert 1950s, right? But it was actually the 1990s. So I'm speaking to a group of 20 Protestant kids. And in passing, in the middle of our discussion, I say, so remind me, what does Jesus say is the great command? All 20 hands go up. I call on one of them. He very proudly tells me about love of God and love of neighbor. And then I say, speaking totally innocently, and Jesus is quoting what? Not a single hand goes up. Not a single hand goes up. This is around 1999, yeah. Just so we have a sense of where we are in time.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking to myself, this is amazing. Of course they think that Judaism is not about love because they don't know what Jesus was quoting, right? They don't know where Jesus got the love from. And so what I realized much later is that on some level, I'm engaged here in a kind of twin project. I'm trying to help Jews reclaim what is fundamental and at the heart of Jewish life. And I'm also hoping that I can help Christians who know they have to talk and think differently about Judaism to find the language with which to do so. A good friend of mine who's a professor of, she has some kind of strange, she's like professor of evangelism at a mainline Christian seminary. And, you know, she said to me that she has alums who say to her on a regular basis, I know that I can't preach from the pulpit what I learned in seminary about Judaism. I know that that's unacceptable, but I actually don't know what I'm supposed to say.
Yes.
And so, you know, my humble hope for this book is that it can help with that project as well.
Yeah. Yeah, this is important. This is one of the reasons we wanted to talk to you, Shai, because what I hear you saying is that maybe it wasn't as surprising to you that Christians have internalized some anti-Semitic ideas about Judaism, but it was more surprising maybe as you woke up to the reality that Jewish people also have internalized Christian anti-Semitic ideas about Judaism.
Yeah. I was just actually reading recently an essay by the philosopher Charles Taylor, in which in passing he says something, which is sort of obvious, but I hadn't quite had this formulation, about how frequent it is for minority groups to internalize the majority group's way of seeing them.
Yes.
And I realized that the history of Jewish spirituality had no small degree of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, one of the differences between Christians and Jewish people is maybe their understanding about love pertaining to loving their enemies. And this is complicated for many Christians because we've been told to love your enemies a lot. But then in Hebrew scripture, there are a number of texts that seem to support hating sinners. And so I'm wondering if maybe you can summarize some of the distinctions on how you see love your enemies.
Yeah, sure. I mean, the truth is that this is a good place to say that I think the picture is sort of more complex than the usual dichotomy of Christians say love your enemies, Jews say defend yourselves. Mm-hmm. And because, first of all, I have found it really interesting the extent to which Christians have always been divided about what love your enemies actually requires. I mean, let's just take the most extreme case. Does loving your enemies entail pacifism? Right? You have Christian ethicists fighting about this, no pun intended, you know, to this day. You have the question of, does love your enemies mean that I can't protect myself? Does it mean that I'm supposed to stay quiet when the weak are being abused? And there's so many questions there. Mm-hmm. And in Jewish ethics, it is certainly true that Jews don't talk about loving your enemies in a kind of unequivocal way. But there are lots of Jewish sources that talk about, I mean, in our daily prayer, three times a day, we pray, may my heart be silent in the face of those who curse me. Mm. Right? That is not a culture of revenge at all. Like, that's right. A culture of, okay, or as a rabbinic passage has it, you know, great are those who are insulted and do not insult in return, right? So you have a lot of that in Jewish ethics too. Where I suggest in the book the key distinction lies, I think, is that when Christian ethicists say that love your enemies is at the heart of Jesus's vision of the good life, I think Jews are much more ambivalent about that. And I'll say as a Jew that sometimes I read Christian thinkers on loving their enemies, and I say this with great love, it strikes me as naive, meaning like I was just reading an essay by a prominent Christian activist who says, you know, if we really got to know our enemies, we would realize that they are not our enemies at all. And I had the reaction, really? So if I were sitting with Bashar Assad or Saddam Hussein over coffee, I would realize that deep down they love me. Mm. I don't think we should succumb to a kind of Pollyannishness when we talk about loving your enemies. The whole point is maybe they are your enemies and you're supposed to love them anyway, not that you're not supposed to be realistic about who they are. So I don't know if this is – I apologize if this is a rambling response.
No,
I just think it's really, really complex. And as a rule, I tend to resist – the sort of Christianity says X, Judaism says Y.
Mm-hmm.
You know, here's another example, if you'll permit me, which I don't talk about in the book at all, which is it is a kind of cliche almost that Christianity believes in forgiving people whether or not they apologize, whereas Judaism thinks you only have to forgive people if they apologize. And there's probably some basis for that argument, although it's interesting that a contemporary Israeli philosopher, Daniel Stotman, argues that actually, according to rabbinic ethics, forgiveness is an unconditional requirement. It has nothing to do with whether the other person apologizes. And one of the most prominent Christian philosophers of forgiveness, Anthony Bash, says, of course you don't forgive someone who doesn't apologize. That would be unjust. So what does Judaism say and what does Christianity say? It's much more complicated than that.
Yeah.
I hope that that's a helpful way of framing some of this.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show. I'm struck by how someone can argue that you have to love your enemies no matter what, and how privileged that idea is. It would be hard to say that in a room full of Holocaust survivors, you know?
Yeah, I think that I mentioned, if I remember correctly, I do mention this point in the book, which is, you know, it's a little complex for Christians who had all the power for 2,000 years to lecture Jews about their failure to love their enemies,
yes,
when in fact Christians instructed Jews as their enemies and didn't exactly love them, right?
Yes.
Jewish history is like littered with corpses of people who were killed in the name of Christian love. And I think we have to be honest about that. I mean, I'm a big believer in this, that interfaith dialogue is not about being polite. It's really about having conversations about really hard stuff.
Yeah.
I think that's really right. And I would also note, I mean, I think it's really interesting. Parts of contemporary American Christianity are hardly models of loving their enemies, right? There's a tremendous amount of demonization. I mean, the culture of let's go Brandon is not exactly a culture of loving your enemies.
Right.
Exactly. I wonder if we could zoom out to that term love, just a little bit. And what, you know, if you're the book here, you know, says that Judaism is about love, and, you know, even the example that we've given here shows that it's kind of a malleable and contested term. But I wonder if you could just give us like a 2 minute on like, how does Judaism understand love? Kind of in your view, if you could give us the, like, is there a way that you can kind of summarize what you mean by that term?
Yeah. Thanks for the question. For me, I have come to think that the most helpful way to think about love in a religious context is really as a disposition to act and feel in certain ways rather than the action or the feeling itself. Mm-hmm. I sort of suggest that it's not that helpful to think of love as defined as an emotion, not least because, as we know, emotions are fleeting. If what it means to love God, let's say, is to have the emotion of deep attachment to God, most of us don't love God most of the time. But if love is more of an existential posture, a way of holding ourselves, an orientation, right? Then I can love God even if what I'm feeling right now is exhaustion and grumpiness, mm-hmm, right? In other words, so I think it's more helpful to think about it as a disposition. Now, if it never manifests in emotion, then the disposition will dissipate. But I don't think it's helpful to define it as an emotion. And it's been interesting to me to discover that a whole bunch of philosophers of the emotions have come to a similar conclusion in the last couple of decades, also saying that not only is love not an emotion, love is not a particular emotion. It's more of an umbrella term for an array of what psychologists call pro-social emotions, gratitude, generosity, compassion. And to me, that's very important. One of the things I try to argue in the book is that compassion should be thought of as a species of love, which is why so much of this book is about compassion. And I this is a little bit of an obscure point, but I found it interesting when I realized a few years ago that in the language of the Talmud, in Babylonian Aramaic, there is no way to distinguish love and compassion. They are the same Hebrew root. I think that's just really interesting.
Yeah.
When we call God Rachamana, the merciful one, that also means the loving one.
Mm.
It's the same word.
Yeah. I really love that. By the way, just defining love as a posture or a disposition. And I guess I'm struck by how similar that is to, I think the way that, for me, at least within my Christian tradition and theology, how similar it is to the way that, you know, that I've learned to define love. And so it's really fascinating, to hear you say that. So, yeah. Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah. One of the parts I appreciated, Shai, was how you navigated the tension in the Jewish scriptures between God's particular unique love for Israel and the call and election of Israel and God's universal love hope for all mankind. I think you call it a particularist universalism. Could you give us a little bit on that? How do we talk about that in a way that does justice to God's love for all humankind and God's love for Israel?
Yeah, you guys are really throwing me some softballs today, huh?
Well, we struggle with this too, right?
Right, of course.
We have, in our Christian tradition, you know, Jesus talks about loving your brothers and sisters, which is sort of the Adelphoi, right? It's meant to be talking about the church, if you will. But then there's also loving your enemies. Yeah. And, you know, we struggle with what's the difference and what's the similarity, you know?
Yeah. So let me start from ethics and then I can sort of maybe back my way into theology. When I say particularist universalism, which is just a term I coined, is, you know, not exactly, you know, the world's most eloquent formulation, but what I'm groping for there is a way of insisting on not dichotomizing between the particular and the universal. That is to say, if you say, are Jews obligated to love their fellow Jews, or are we obligated to love all humanity? The answer to that is yes, right? And we don't love everyone by effacing differences. We love everyone by acknowledging and celebrating differences. Mm-hmm. I think it's really interesting that Genesis 1-11, for example, is so interested in linguistic and cultural diversity. And in my last book, I try to argue that that's actually the meaning of the Tower of Babel story, is that God, what God is resisting there is not some tower that is threatening to God, but the culture of uniformity whereby everyone would have the same language and speak the same words. And God essentially forces the people back to the path of blessing that God has set out for them, which includes diversity, which includes difference, which includes thinking and hearing differently. So I think that Judaism, on the one hand, look, we have this idea that is obviously has been enormously complicated for in its reception and its and grappling with its meaning, this idea that God has, to use, you know, a biblical image, fallen in love with Abraham and has a particular covenant with Israel. And yet it is a mistake, I think, to say, as some people are tempted to say, both defenders of chosenness and opponents of chosenness are sometimes said to say, well, God's love is somehow exclusive. And I just think that that's sort of manifestly untrue. One example that I use is an argument that the Bible scholar Patrick Miller developed, which is like it's really striking that in Deuteronomy, the text goes out of its way to emphasize that God gave Natan in Hebrew lands to other peoples and not just Israel. It's not just that God gives Canaan to the Jews. It's that God gives the land of Moab to the Moabites and God gives, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, Genesis actually chooses. Here's something that's really interesting, I think. As far as I know, ancient Israel was the only culture in the ancient world that told a creation story in which it was not primordial. Or to say that in, you know, English for a second, right? Ancient Israel told a creation story which didn't include ancient Israel, right? It told a creation story that was about Adam, not Abraham. And, you know, the Bible scholar John Levinson wonderfully calls that the universal horizon of biblical particularism, which I think is just a wonderful formulation. In other words, you have to go to Genesis 12 before you hear of Abraham. And that's I think, really striking and important. I think that it's worth saying that there is a kind of, I would say a tension in the tendencies here between Judaism and Christianity. So let me give you an example. You know, as you know better than I, Christians have long struggled with whether love your neighbor means that I'm supposed to love every person in the world equally, right? Equal regard, as philosophers like to say. And does that mandate impartiality?
Yeah.
Jews never really had that conversation because Jews were always suspicious of a universalism that simply elided or skipped over the particular. The way you get to the universal is through the particular, not around it or instead of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, when Kierkegaard struggles with, you know, can I have special loves? Judaism never questions whether I can have special loves. Now, each of those positions has its costs. I'm not saying, you know, I'm certainly not arguing in a kind of triumphalistic way. If you start with the particular, the danger is that you'll also end up there, right? In other words, family first descends into family only.
Yes.
But if you start with the universal, the danger is that you'll never actually love anyone in particular. And, you know, it strips people, I think, of kind of the heart of what human ethical life is like, that of course we have particular loves. Of course I love my kids more than I love your kids, even though your kids make a real moral and spiritual claim on me. It's not the same moral and spiritual claim. And this, I think, opens up into the larger question of how Jews and Christians have thought about particularity and universality. And one of the things I've argued in earlier writings and I repeat in this book is that here too, Jews living in a majority Christian culture have internalized the idea that universalism is unequivocally better than particularism. And so they're taught to be embarrassed about purported Jewish particularism. But in fact, you know, for thousands of years, universalism was the opposite of pluralism. Universalism went hand in hand with imperialism, right? If I'm a universalist, I want you to think like me. And so my formulation of this, in case this is helpful to any of your listeners, is that, you know, Judaism has always excelled at leaving people alone, but it has sometimes forgotten to care about them. Christianity has always excelled at caring about everyone, but it took it 2,000 years to consider ever leaving anyone alone.
That's so good, Shai.
And so, you know, history is filled with corpses of Christian universalism.
Yes.
So I just think we need more complex language for thinking about some of this. That's what particularist universalism is a kind of groping for.
Yeah.
Well, I hear you saying it's both and I think, at least in my Christian circles, so many people are like black and white and don't see things like aren't able to hold two things at the same time. And I'm thankful for your encouragement of let's look at this a different way. Let's turn the prism to see it from a different angle and maybe have the imagination that it can be both and, that people can be cared for and included. Am I hearing you right?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think it goes back to what I said earlier about sort of celebrating passion rather than certainty.
Yeah.
I think the world is a really complex place. I mean, it also has to do with how do religious people interact with people who are not religious? Do we come from a place of we know the truth and you don't, so we come to enlighten you? Or do we come to a place of, you know, we all of us have been thrown into a world that is really ambiguous and hard to figure out. Can we possibly consider just listening to each other a bit? Like, I'd like to hear your story. Tell me how you see – my main response to someone who says I'm an atheist is like, tell me about the world as you see it, not, oh, you're benighted and it is my task to save you. Now, of course, Judaism and Christianity are different in this way in that Judaism never thought you had to be Jewish to have a relationship with God. Christianity always has had a more difficult time with that question. But I just think, yes, I mean – first of all, both and. The way I like to say this is that sometimes religion is better at giving us language for the questions than it is at offering us answers.
Yeah.
So I definitely embrace that both and. I mean, there are times and places where we should unequivocally say yes or no about something. But a lot of times it's yes and.
Sure. Well, you mentioned this before. I want to go back because you talked a little bit about forgiveness, and I'm wondering if we can kind of double click on that and kind of really focus in. But you talk about forgiveness and how it's related to love. And for many of us, that's a – like forgiveness, there's a complicated relationship we have with it. We know that we are supposed to do it, or we are like, yes, I think this, but we don't really know how. And so – I'm curious to hear, how do you see forgiveness and love related, and what are some of the complications that you see in forgiving?
Another softball. you know, it's interesting. Forgiveness is one of the things that I have a whole list of topics that I wanted to go into more depth in the book, and the book was already way longer than my editor found acceptable. And so I had, you know, about three chapters that I wrote and then didn't end up including, and then outlines for a few more. And one of them was to think about how to talk about forgiveness, how best to talk about forgiveness in a Jewish way. And I'll mention one aspect of forgiveness that I have been finding helpful just personally, not making any sweeping claims about this. There is a teaching in the Mishnah, in the earliest kind of layer of rabbinic teachings, that we are supposed to judge every person favorably. And in a kind of creative misreading of that phrase, some modern interpreters have interpreted the Hebrew to mean not to see every person favorably, but to see the entirety of the person favorably. And what one particular ultra-Orthodox rabbi I quote in the book talks about is, you know, one thing that's sometimes helpful is, do I know the story of this person and how they ended up where they were and what might have led them to act in this way? I'm not in the business of justifying when people do hurtful things, but I can maybe learn to empathize with them if I know more of what led them here. Now, obviously, you know, we can talk about the extreme cases and how they problematize everything. But like when we're just talking about like a personal relationship, someone who hurt me at work, someone who, you know, a friend who let me down, it's sometimes helpful to, I think, just sort of like take a step back and think about their lives rather than just how they hurt and disappointed us. And to me, there's something like deeply religious about that, because it stems from a spiritual practice of trying to see other human beings in the most generous possible light. Or, you know, as I sometimes refer, to aspire to see people the way God sees them. And the word aspire there is really important, both because, A, I don't know what God thinks. I don't pretend to know that. I'm scared of religious people who do. But and B, I'm also a flesh and blood human being with wounds and limits. But so I don't know if that's helpful. That's a kind of an idiosyncratic response, but it's where my own thinking these days is. You know, I just find myself trying to get to the point where when people hurt me a lot, to try and understand a little bit about kind of how they ended up where they ended up.
Yeah. Yeah. The perspective that we have, if we can change our perspective to how are they walking into this room? What has gone on in their day? What conversations have they had? What happened 20 years ago that is now impacting how they're responding to me?
Right. What did their mother say to them that made them feel like they were worthless? Right. I mean, what, you know, and so I think that that's, and to your question, that to me is deeply about love. Love is also a form of seeing, I think. Like, how do you look at people?
Yes.
And are you willing to look generously even at people who really have disappointed you? You know, there's a Robert Roberts, you know, who's a Christian ethicist whose work I really admire. He has an essay in which he says something about how when someone hurts us, there's a temptation to see them as almost monstrous, like they become a kind of like monster to us. And I think love pushes us to sort of insist on their humanity precisely when we're tempted to turn them into monsters.
Yeah.
And now, a word from a sponsor.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger. For the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
Okay, Rabbi, I'm feeling I got a lot of feelings going on inside, and there's stuff I got to chew on now in my own personal life. So I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you. What I was reminded of when you said love is a form of seeing is, and you can correct, I hope you correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't that what Hagar says to God in the wilderness, that you are the God who sees me? And isn't that in Genesis 16, one of, if not the first time God's given a name?
Yeah. So I would say I'm so grateful that you bring up that story, because it seems to me that that story is really core to biblical theology in a way that is surprising to a lot of people. You have a story of, just sort of get the flip, an Egyptian slave with Israelite masters. Yeah. That in itself should give you a little bit of a headache, right? An Egyptian slave with Israelite masters. And really strikingly, if you read the text, the Israelite masters, Abraham and Sarah, never address her or speak of her by name. No. She is nameless to them. And then an angel appears to her when she runs away. And the first word the angel says is Hagar, her name. The very first word he speaks to her is to name her, as if to say, I know you're a human being. I see that. And amazingly, at the end of that scene, she says to God, Ata El Roi in Hebrew, you are the God who sees me. Or maybe you are the God of vision. I mean, same idea, right? And she is, I think, not only the first, but the only character in the Hebrew Bible who gives God a name. And what a name, right? You're the God who sees me. It's no wonder, by the way, that Hagar becomes a kind of hero in African-American womanist theology, because here you have this woman who is presumably, you know, not a white lady, right? Who is having this remarkable encounter with God, who, by the way, that goes back, Matt, to your earlier question, right? This is not a God who is not interested in the well-being of Egyptians, say, enemies of Israel, presumably, right? So I think there's something actually quite moving there. And there's also this really radical ethical lesson that I think the Torah is suggesting, which is that the role of victim and victimizer is not essentialized, right? In other words, there is a world in which Israelites oppress Egyptians, just as there is a world in which Egyptians oppress Israelites, right? So nobody is victim with a capital V in all times and in every circumstance. That's actually something I develop a little bit in my previous book, The Heart of Torah, because I do think Genesis 16 is such an integral text, and it is wildly subversive. Mm. I was certainly never taught that text as a kid, and certainly not in this way.
Well, Shaw, we could talk to you for a long time. I'd love to hear. I know Christy's preaching on the sacrifice of Isaac in a couple of weeks. And we've been talking about this, Christy, offline a little
bit. That's a lighthearted story.
Yes. It's so hard. I have so many questions.
So hard.
But I do wonder, you mentioned interfaith dialogue, and this is one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on, Shai, because I think that for so long, many of us, like you mentioned earlier, how Jewish people carry sort of anti-Semitic tropes and ideas. I think just this past Sunday, I'm teaching on the New Testament, and I was confessing to my congregation, I'm a priest, that I carried anti-Semitic ideas unbeknownst to me, right? I wonder, what are two or three things that you hope Christians, or you would wish Christians would take away from this book? And how have you experienced Christians engaging in interfaith dialogue? How have you experienced that in helpful ways? So maybe I'm asking, what are some gifts that you think that this book can offer to the Christian? And then what are some ways that you've experienced Christians engaging Judaism in ways that have been helpful to you as a Jewish person?
Wow, that's a really like a beautiful set of questions and challenging. So let me say a couple things. You know, one is almost on a very simplistic level, almost my invitation to Christian readers is for many of them, sadly, to see Judaism for the first time in all of its richness, complexity, and beauty, right? I guess I would say that I have learned from Christians over the years. This is not the answer to your second question. It's still part of the first one. I've learned from Christian over the years how hard it can be for those raised in certain kinds of Christian environments to acknowledge and see the sort of robustness of other traditions. And I think there is kind of, my hope is that at least, you know, to some extent this book, I mean, that's my hope, at least my prayer, that this book captures some of the richness of the Jewish tradition. And I, you know, so I hope Christians can see that about other religions in general and about Judaism in particular. I think also, I remember a conversation I had with a Christian Hebrew Bible scholar who, when I told her years ago that I was writing a book about love, she said, "Oh God, as a Christian, I don't want to hear any more about love. It's such a cliche." And I found that to be very painful and, you know, upsetting in a way. And what I would love readers, both Jewish and Christian, to come away with, in part, is the sense that love is hard work. It's the task of a lifetime.
Yeah.
And it requires really deep thought and wisdom. It's not like some cute, easy, it is the farthest thing in the world from Hallmark, right? So so the richness of the Jewish tradition, the complexity and demandingness of love. And also, you know, if I could be so bold, I'm a little hesitant to say this because I don't want it to come out the wrong way, but I think the willingness to acknowledge in religious settings when we don't know something or when we find a question confusing, like in some ways, I hope that my chapter on loving enemies can model for people sometimes being willing to say, this is really hard and I'm just a human being and I'm trying to make my way in the world. I don't know what the answer to this question is, right? I find that to be helpful and salutary. And I wish more religious people were less certain in certain ways. So that's what I would say about, you know, the first question. Yeah. In terms of what I've learned from Christians, so that's a really interesting question. And the truth is, I would say, interestingly enough, that I have learned more from Christians when I'm eavesdropping on their conversations with each other than when I'm talking to them about Jewish-Christian relations. Mm. You know, like, this is almost a random example, but one of the things I'm often finding myself trying to understand is when I read Miroslav Volf, I find that a lot of his readings of the Christian tradition and my readings of the Jewish tradition are almost identical. And I'm always just like, what's happening here? Why is that? Right? In other words, how do we come out of different traditions, although with some obviously deeply shared heritage, and end up talking about, you know, I have a chapter in the book about gratitude and generosity, which is like totally central to Miroslav's vision of Christianity. And there are other examples too about protest as a path to discovering God, which is, you know, something he's written about as well. I don't know if this is really an answer to your question. In a funny way, I'm sidestepping it. But I think, honestly, the thing that I find most moving in interfaith dialogue that is real and deep and substantive is genuine curiosity and eagerness to learn from another person and where they come from, right? It's not taking turns giving speeches. Yes. It's listening.
Yes.
You know, I'll just share that one of the things I'm most looking forward to about this book, the Templeton Foundation was generous enough to make possible. I have 15 Christian theologians and Hebrew Bible scholars coming together to spend a couple days with me talking about what this book means to them. And I've rarely looked forward to anything quite as much in my intellectual life and my spiritual life, because the very idea of having that conversation is so moving to me.
Yeah.
Like, when have Jews and Christians ever been able to do this kind of thing together?
Ah.
So I feel incredibly grateful for their openness and receptivity.
Yeah. I share your perspective that's precious, right? And what an honor that the impetus to gather is to talk about your scholarship, which is just really cool. Maybe just for our listeners as we close here. I hear what you just said. I tie it back to your describing the particularistic, how Jews start from the particular and work to the universal. And that may, and how their social location throughout history of not being in a supremacist or privileged position, maybe gave them access to that way of doing theology or being human. And I think it's been named in other contexts as like a lot of white Western Christians have a sort of a colonial hangover where we do right. think that we can see everything and control everything and dominate everything and understand everything. And it's been to our and others' detriment. It's done great harm in the world. And so I just want to thank you for the commendation to rediscover learning as though we don't know, and to come underneath up people and listen. And I appreciate listening to you today, Shai. This book, again, is called Judaism is About Love, Recovering the Heart of the Jewish Life. Before we close, Shai, I want to give you a chance to maybe just say a brief word about your podcast and the Haidar Institute and your work there.
Yeah, thank you. And really, thank you for the open-heartedness with which you've received me. I think the podcast really actually is related to what we talked about here. Answers Withheld is the pun I'm most proud of. The idea is that it's Answers Withheld with a capital H, right. But also that it's not about the answers.
Yeah. It's that, fantastic. I wanted to comment on it earlier. So thank you so much for that. It's incredible. It's like your life's work. It's incredible.
I appreciate that. No, and you know, the idea behind the podcast is lots of people have kids asking them theological questions and they feel totally inadequate to answer them. And so they get embarrassed or they get ashamed or they fumfer. And it's about, can we help people have language with which to talk to kids? And can we help them grow more comfortable in saying, you know, I don't know the answer to that either. That's really interesting. You know, like when a child asks why innocent people suffer, don't pretend that you alone in the history of humanity know the answer. Right. Don't pretend. Talk to them, right? Have a conversation with them. You know, this is a big piece of my philosophy of education. Never condescend to anyone anywhere, right? Don't condescend to kids. They're really smart.
Yeah.
Right? So the Haidar Institute in a couple senses, you know, was built on, I would say, two projects, one of which is to lay a stake in the ground for the idea that you can be deeply rooted in tradition, deeply committed to it and its authority, and at the same time being committed to gender equality and egalitarianism. Mm-hmm. That was piece number one. Piece number two is, can we model a kind of engagement with tradition that is deeply and unapologetically religious, but humble enough to learn from the modern world, to learn from academic scholarship, to take philosophy seriously, and to take students seriously that doesn't kind of pretend to spoon feed them easy answers to difficult questions, but takes them seriously as adults and as fellow journeyers in this, you know, endlessly challenging thing we call life.
Well, I'm going to chasten my overwhelming urge to ask you about how to operate in a tradition, be faithful to it, and be work for gender equality and egalitarianism. I'm not going to ask you any questions about that. We're going to let you go. Shai.
Next time.
I would love it. I would love it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you all so much.
I've got a lot of questions and a lot of thoughts. Do you have stuff, Matt? You look like you're about to say something.
I mean, I could have talked to Shai forever, but he did give me a great idea. I'm going to start a new podcast, and it's going to be called Answers with Tebby.
the pun doesn't quite work. Yeah,
no, it's just answers.
It's not
with me.
There's no pun at all. It's just me, and I'm giving people answers.
Yeah. Man, maybe it could be like the villain to his superhero podcast, where I'm just doing sort of parodies of how to not how to not respond to kids' questions.
Right. You're not respond. You're just giving answers. There's no pun in the title at all.
No. It's, nope.
It's not even clever. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's great.
You guys, I referenced that I had to own this past Sunday as I was teaching a class at my church that I have these anti-Semitic sort of ideas. Yeah. And we didn't get into this with Shai, but one of the things he talks about is that it's often thought of that, you know, Judaism is the religion of works and law, and Christianity mm-hmm. is the religion of grace.
Right.
And one of the things that I'm relearning from Jewish people like Shai is that the law is grace. Mm-hmm. That grace wasn't invented with Jesus.
Right.
and we have a long history of saying that and believing that, and I think this book is so important as those of us who are privileged in a privileged place in Western society to listen carefully with great compassion to people who don't have our privilege, yeah. don't have our place, mm-hmm. Because they can teach us a lot yeah. about things we think we already know.
Yeah. Yeah, it struck me in that interview. And listener, I mean, I know you can't see, but I think you can hear it even, is when you were talking about love and there are differences with Judaism and Christianity and the way in which his demeanor, I felt like he was oozing love.
Yeah.
He was yeah. oozing like yeah. compassion. He was mm-hmm. this example of what I think the foundation of both Christianity and Judaism is, which is love. Mm-hmm. And he mm-hmm. represented that in his being, not just in his words.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It was it was really good. And I agree with you that I could have talked with him a long time, just a gracious presence. And man, I'm still thinking about is his little quip about how one of the things Christians can learn from Jews is maybe perhaps how to leave people alone.
Yes.
And you know, it was like a funny quip, you know, it was very funny. But I think there's something about that really resonated with me. I was like, there's something that feels like a really big paradigm shift for me.
Yeah.
And it's not, you know, it's obviously overstated to be funny. It's not like we want to leave people alone, but there's something about love that I had to learn that sometimes does leave people alone. That doesn't harangue or try to get them to do something good or like, anyway. So I think there's something about that I had to learn was sometimes that's faithful.
Yeah.
Is just
yeah.
to leave people alone and to, you know, oh, they're not interested in what I have to say. That's fine. I can just yeah. let them live their life.
Plus, Ben, full disclosure, listener. Mm-hmm.
Are you Ben's disclosing on my behalf?
Oh, yes.
That's how, okay.
yeah, of course.
All right. Okay. Okay.
Full disclosure, listener, Ben's love language is please leave me alone.
It's kind of true.
Okay. Hey, Christy, knock, knock.
Oh, who's there?
Interrupting Sloth.
Interrupting Sloth who?
Sloth.
I'm going to use that on my sixth grader today.
You know what, Christy? You knew the punchline as you were saying.
I was like, if I go slower, he's going to not be able to do it. And then he just yeah. after anyway.
Just me out. Outweighted you. That's, so
it's so good. So it's great when you get the joke before the punchline.
It's like, I know what's happening.
It's so good.
Not gonna say it.
I'm expecting the, you know, anyway.
All right, listener. Yeah.
All right, y'all. Well, I got to go.
Have a Me great too. Day.
Peace, y'all. Bye.
Peace.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity community. It's free to join, and you can connect there with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith and spirituality and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsternke.com. Finally, we would love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, you can go to gravitycommons.com/message and click the start recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.